Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Even though the Bay Area is home to the independent living movement, California students rarely learn about the struggles and the victories of people with disabilities. And when they do, the issue is framed around a medical or charity model. But thanks to the FAIR Act, this is about to change. The FAIR Act updates California's education code to include the role of contributions of minority groups, and that includes people with disabilities. So today's On Your Call, we're going to talk about what a more empowering and inspiring disability curriculum would look like. And today we're joined by two guests. Catherine Kudlick is professor of history and director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability at San Francisco State. Catherine teaches about disability history, and she oversaw the Patient No More, People with Disabilities Securing Civil Rights exhibit that'll return to the Bay Area next summer. Catherine is currently co-editing the Oxford Handbook of Disability History, and she joins me here in studio. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Christina Mills, the Deputy Director of the California Foundation for Independent Living Centers. Christina has been an active member of the disability rights community since her involvement in the California Youth Leadership Forum for Students with Disabilities back in 1995. Christina is also the co-founder of Youth Organizing, Disabled and Proud, and was recently appointed to the California Advisory Commission on Special Education. And Catherine joins us on the line from her office in Sacramento. Hi, Christina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
It's great to have both of you. So, Catherine, I want to start off with you. Oakland North had an interesting article about how the FAIR Act came to be, and it reported that when State Senator Mark Leno first introduced the FAIR Act, it specifically focused on LGBTQ representation. But Brandon Tartaglia, a legislative advocate with Disability Rights California, who says he knew Leno to be friendly with the disability community, asked if the bill could be expanded to include individuals with disabilities. Mark Leno said yes, and here we are today. So this is a big victory for the disability rights community.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I don't know the particulars of it, but what's really fascinating is that disability gave GLBT or LGBT rights an opportunity that they would be less threatening if disability rights was included in the bill. Disability stuff is way less controversial than gay, lesbian stuff. So the disability community kind of gave it this imprimatur, this idea of innocence, and like we can bring these people in and everybody will benefit. So it wasn't just the disability community gaining something from being associated with this broader bill, but the people in these other groups also benefited from the seemingly feel-good issue of disability.
And the other groups, in addition to the LGBT, you've got the comfort women in World War II are going to be taught now, the Armenian genocide, discrimination faced by Sikh Americans. And what Brandon Tartaglia said at the time is that people with disabilities are kind of an afterthought generally. He said they are kind of pushed aside, but in reality, people with disabilities are affecting everybody in our lives. Christina, what would you add to that?
Well, I really believe that disability is an intersectionality issue, and all of those groups that you just talked about, I'm sure, include people with disabilities. So we're one of the only minority groups that also encompasses a variety of other cultural diversity communities, and you can enter our community at any given time, whether it be at birth or at a later point in time during your lifespan. So, I'm friends with Brandon. I work with him frequently, and I can remember the day that Leno made that amendment in the bill and how exciting it was and how excited the youth of Youth Organizing Disabled and Proud were, because we had had accomplished creating a disability history resolution through the legislature with former Senator, former Assemblyman Jim Bell from San Jose, who had sponsored that resolution, and it was passed in August of 2010. And it was a really big deal for us to move forward and then get disability history also put in the FAIR Act, because our resolution was just encouraging schools to acknowledge disability history during the second week of October each year. But the FAIR Act really put disability history on the map, now requiring K through 12 social science teachers to teach it.
And the FAIR Act is getting a lot of media attention, but the section about teaching the history of disability rights is really not. The section about teaching LGBT history is getting a ton of attention across the country, but not really the disability section. So, Christina, what do students in California currently learn about the disability rights movement?
Well, first I want to applaud the LGBT community, because I think they've done a great job of organizing and getting their curriculum and their priorities in line for the curriculum that's being developed. The youth in California, through Youth Organizing Disabled and Proud, which is a statewide project of the California Foundation for Independent Living Centers, youth across the state have told us historically, and this is why, again, we prioritized it, that they're not learning about disability history in school, and that it's one of those reasons that they can feel very segregated and very very unconnected with the mainstream communities in their school and throughout the systems that they're a part of. And they had very much felt that if we could teach disability history in schools to both disabled and non-disabled students, what a powerful systematic change and impact that would have on generations to come, knowing that, you know, disability history does exist, and that there's an amazing amount of history that goes way back before my time and before Kathy's time on disability history that is worth knowing. And, you know, what Kathy and the Longmore Institute have done with the Patients No More exhibit is just one part of our history with the 504 sit-in that is really important, and most people don't know about it, and even people with disabilities. So I think that, again, this is why the youth really wanted to push it and got it to where it is.
And we'll talk about that exhibition in just a couple minutes. But first, Catherine, you're professor of history at San Francisco State. Mm-hmm. When you first meet your students, do you meet any who learned about disability rights history in high school?
No, never.
Never.
Almost never. Maybe one in 1,000 that I end up interacting with, because really they don't think that disability has a history. For most people, disability is this biological thing. It happens to you. Your body doesn't work. And that's the end of the story for people. Let's fix it. Let's make these disabled people go away, and then we'll all move on and be normal. And, you know, that's a very crude summary, but that's kind of how most people approach it. And when you look at disability history in a broader context, you see it intersecting, as Christina says, with all sorts of other kinds of identities and all sorts of other conversations. So, for example, in all the debates over the slavery movement, you know, to the abolition of slavery, both sides of the conversation used disability to either disparage slaves and say they were less able and they were something wrong with their bodies, they were different, or to talk about how people were being disabled by the fact that they were treated as slaves. So people use disability in the background to justify all kinds of inequality and all kinds of forms of Americanness that we don't necessarily think about it, but the slurs are in there, the denigrations, all of that stuff. Disability is right at the core of every insult. Mm-hmm. And so if people start thinking about the insults they use as part of a bigger history, then it's really interesting.
Yeah, and we have a lot of insults being thrown around during the presidential election. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've seen people use these slurs in referencing candidates or referencing politicians they don't like, for example.
Yep, exactly. And it's everywhere. They talk about madness and somebody lame or that's retarded or, you know, and all of that. And that's one of the ways that history kind of, once you understand history and once you understand the origins of the words that you're using and how they're, you know, used to denigrate people and what harm they do, then you can start to really discover what power is and what power resides in disability in a way.
So this is a really big shift for California and California's curriculum. Where do you begin when you decide that you're going to incorporate the history, for example, the history of people with disabilities, the movements, the struggles, the victories? How do you even begin that process?
It's a great question. I think that you want to start by tying it to things that people already know, because I think disability is already seemingly foreign to enough people that you want to tie it into things like immigration, the history of immigration, the history of slavery, the history of debates over women's rights, the history of civil rights even. You can use all of these things as starter places to kind of introduce disability into what people already know. Once you have that in place, then people who know things can start to branch out and discover that what's unique about disability and disability rights and these movements.
Christina, what would you add?
I think Kathy is right on, and I can appreciate that and can understand why we might want to start there. I also think that in California and across the nation, we have a variety of resources, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention the Bancroft Library in Berkeley. They have a whole disability history section, and I think that if we could start there by adding in information like Kathy's exhibit on the 504 and, independent living history and the movement and how it began, and things newer, like it's newer to me, the Olmstead decision, where we had two women with developmental disabilities and mental health disabilities, one who happens to be a person of color, who were institutionalized and wanted to live out in the community and have a choice in where they lived. And they fought their way all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And Lois Curtis is the surviving plaintiff of the case. And she happens to be an African-American intellectually disabled woman. And for me, I think, oh my gosh, how powerful would that be for more people with intellectual disabilities and their families and their peers to know that those stories exist and that those fights were won for a reason. I think there's just so much out there that we could take from that's available to us. And on our Youth Organizing Disabled and Proud website, in our disability history section, we have some sample curriculum and worksheets and things that can be used right now by anybody across the nation or around the world that wants to use it. And I also want to say that there's a number of disability history museums opening up, and one of the oldest ones is the one in Syracuse, New York, and that one is a fabulous resource. And there's curation of all different kinds of disability history museum information springing up everywhere. And American History Smithsonian also has had curriculum and curations of different disability history stories shared in their exhibits.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about our exhibit, also the Patient No More exhibit. We have an online version of that exhibit that's got amazing curriculum, not just about the exhibit, but actually situating disability history so that people that are new to it can really discover it and find the great resources and all that. And there's stuff that's out there. It's everywhere. But the thing is, people don't know to look for it. And that's the challenge, is to get the word out. So,
well, right. And also, how do you – I mean, right now, teachers in California are really struggling. They don't have a lot of resources. In fact, school just started. A lot of my friends were buying their own school supplies. They're buying food for kids who are hungry in the classroom. So how do you work with teachers who are already struggling on incorporating new curriculum?
Well, one of these, and I'll let Christina talk about what Yo's doing, the Youth Disabled and Proud, but one of the things that we're doing is our exhibit, Patient No More, which is a history of this moment in disability rights. We have a traveling exhibit that's going around to different school districts, and so people bring their classes in, and we give talks. We talk to teachers. We talk to the students themselves, and we have the interactive exercises that they can do when they go to visit the exhibit, so it's not just, paper, text on pictures on the wall, but they really get to interact with it and think about it. So, it's kind of a ready-made, built-in thing that people can, bring to their schools, they can bring to their classes, and we have the curriculum. And so it's a really exciting way. People don't have to reinvent the wheel. We have materials Again, it's a matter of getting the word out there. And I know Yo! Disabled and Proud are doing all sorts of curriculum and class presentations too, right?
Christina?
So in addition to the curriculum that I mentioned on our website earlier, we've also had a disability history poster published every year. And the youth in our program will decide what the theme of that poster should be, what's the hot topic of the year. And then they and our graphic design team put something together that we make available on our website. And it's available for a small donation, but for teachers or for anybody who's working at a school, if they register their school to at least acknowledge and do something in support of Disability History Week in October, we send them a free poster. And that might seem like something very small, but just to have something positive, disability-related mm-hmm. in your classroom or around your school can be very powerful and puts a new twist on the way people identify as people with disabilities themselves and families and allies coming into that school that see something positive around disability for the first time instead of, you know, just the stereotypes around kids with disabilities and special education being pushed to portables in the back of the school grounds. And I'm looking at one of the posters in my office right now, and it's a quote, and it says, "Disability is a strength," from Ed Roberts, who is the father of the independent living movement, who founded one of the founders of the first independent living center.
And that is Christina Mills. She's deputy director of the California Foundation for Independent Living Centers. Catherine Kudlick is professor of history and director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability at San Francisco State. Today, we are talking about curriculum in California schools. You may have heard of the FAIR Act. It updates the state's education code to include the role of contributions of minority groups, and this includes the LGBT community. They're going to also teach about Sikh Americans. They're going to teach about the Comfort Women in World War II, the Armenian Genocide, and people with disabilities. As it stands, most kids don't really learn much about this issue, and so the FAIR Act is going to change that. And we'd love to hear from you. If you are in education, if you're a teacher, if you have kids in school, we'd love to hear from you. What changes would you like to see when it comes to teaching children about the struggles and victories of people with disabilities? And if you have a disability, what are your thoughts on this? In fact, it'd be great to share resources because we're talking today about the best ways to bring this information into the classroom. So if you have any suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at yourcallradio. And Catherine, you've been talking about the Patient No More exhibit that will return to the Bay Area next summer. And I was really impressed with the website. I mean, you've got really great videos. There are a ton of audio clips. So you kind of almost feel like you're at the museum. But there's so much that happened here in the Bay Area that a lot of people do not know about. So tell us about what happened with Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which made it illegal for any federally funded facilities or programs to discriminate against disabled people.
So basically, people had signed, the law had been signed, it was all ready to go. And the way laws work, you need somebody that's going to step in and implement the law. You need to sign things into effect, not just that the law is there, but that there's some sort of way to, you know, really follow through and make sure the law has teeth. And they waited and waited and waited for 4 years. The disability community was waiting for the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Joseph Califano, to sign it. There had been previous administrations. They had gotten cold feet. They wouldn't sign the mandate. The Carter administration came in saying, "We are going to sign this. This is great. We're going to implement it. It's going to be no problem." And Carter gets elected, and still they don't sign it. So
why?
I think they got cold feet because they were worried it would be either too expensive, it would result in lawsuits. They didn't really know how they were going to go about handling it? I mean, you know, it's a big, far-reaching law with a lot of implications because basically it said you couldn't discriminate against people with disabilities in any government-funded agency. Mm. And that affects schools, universities, hospitals, post offices, everything. And so people, I think, were getting wind in these areas. University people were among the people that struggled most valiantly against passing the 504 legislation, saying, you know, this is going to cost us too much money. It's going to be really difficult. It's going to, you know, upset, you know, the way we do things, all of that. And so they had the ear of the administrations and people were frightened. So the disability community, such as it was at the time, it was pretty fragmented and very diffuse. But nonetheless, there were a few people that were starting to say, wait a minute, this is wrong. And we need to do something about it. So they called, it was a national movement. They asked for people across the United States with disabilities to occupy the federal offices. I think there were 9 of them across the country that ended up being occupied. One of them was in San Francisco in 1977 in April. And all the other ones folded. After a few hours, they were threatened either by the police or, you know, kind of ushered out, or they were never allowed in the first place. San Francisco, they got in the door. They would not leave. And they had this, and they were able to stay for a number of really interesting reasons. It's the longest nonviolent occupation of a federal building. They stayed for 26 days. More than 150 people with disabilities and their allies occupied the federal building in downtown San Francisco, saying, "We will not leave until this legislation is signed." And they stayed, and they had support from this amazing coalition of groups. The organizers of the protest had built coalitions with the Black Panther movement, with Glide Memorial Church, with Delancey Street, all these iconic San Francisco areas. They'd built kind of good relations with local politicians like Congressman George Miller, with Mayor Harvey Milk, with all sorts of different people within the community. And so when it came time for these people to say, we're digging in, they had amazing support. One of the occupiers was a disabled Black man named Bradley Lomax, who had the support of the Black Panther Party. They brought food then every day. They said one of their big programs was to feed people in need, and they saw the protests as in need. So a lot of the protesters that were occupying the building were fed every day by the Black Panther Party. You know, it's just an amazing coalition. And eventually it got so publicly embarrassing for all these disabled people occupying this building that eventually they, you know, the government caved in and signed the legislation. And that's the basis of the Americans with Disabilities Act today.
Amazing story. We actually have a caller who'd like to talk about the Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Let's hear from Rufan in El Cerrito. Hi, Rufan.
Hi there. Thank you so much for doing this show. What I was going to say is I worked extensively with and was friendly with the late Paul Longmore before he died, and I think that he would very much be upset or would really want, and you've already mentioned this, so I didn't know if I was going to get included, that Section 504 is a really critical part of our history. I'm a person with a physical disability.
Absolutely.
As the basis for everything, and I think is a role model for people, for them to know that it, that those sit-ins were the impetus behind and were the basis for a lot of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and how critical that protest was for inspiring not only other people with disabilities to take such action, but also to cross-fertilize with different groups who want to propose and enforce getting legislation passed. That was
absolutely, yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, thank you for calling in, Rufan. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are talking about the FAIR Act, which updates the state's education code to include the role of contributions of minority groups, and that includes people with disabilities. Currently, students in California don't really learn much about the disability rights movement, and that is about to change. So we are talking about what a more empowering and inspiring disability curriculum would look like. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on 91.7 KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at klw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Come Out Right Now returns Thursday, August 18th, live from the Swedish American Hall in San Francisco. W. Kamau Bell's guests will include comedian Hari Kondabolu. Show starts at 7 p.m. For tickets and information, go to kalw.org. And if you can't be there in person, catch the show live Thursday evening at 91.7 KALW or subscribe to the podcast.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with journalist David Dayan about his new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He tells the story of three victims of the subprime crisis and how they exposed fraud and forced mortgage companies to stop repossessing homes. They also saw firsthand the U.S. government's refusal to bring those responsible to justice. That is tomorrow. And then Thursday, we are going to talk about end of summer activities because we all need to do something fun, especially those of us who follow these issues on a regular basis so closely. So I hope you can join us for that. Today, we are talking about something that's really exciting happening in California schools. The FAIR Act was updated to the, basically updates the state's education code to include the role of contributions of the LGBT community. It's going to include information on the, quote, comfort women in World War II, the Armenian Genocide, discrimination faced by Sikh Americans, and for the very first time, it will include the history of people with disabilities. It'll focus on their struggles and their victories. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on this? If you work in education, if you have a child in school, if you are a person with a disability and you'd like to share resources, what would you like to add to this curriculum? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. We're joined today by Catherine Kudlick, professor of history and director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability at San Francisco State. She teaches disability history and oversaw the Patient No More, People with Disabilities Securing Civil Rights exhibit. It'll return to the Bay Area next summer, and it is online now. There's really great information on their website. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. In fact, Catherine was just talking about the Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act victory. There's videos, there's photos, there's audio. In fact, we have one of the photos at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Christina Mills, Deputy Director of the California Foundation for Independent Living Centers. Christina is co-founder of Youth Organizing Disabled and Proud. And let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. As a disabled person who's struggling in Palo Alto with a government that's not very amenable to dealing with disability issues, except for accessibility, my feeling is that I'm glad that this is going to be included, but I think the important issue is going to be what's the content going to be? How are they going to cover people with disabilities, the discrimination that they've experienced for I don't know how many years, and the discrimination and difficulties that they're having today? I have no problem with dealing with the history of this. It's just that I haven't looked at a high school textbook recently to know how slavery was dealt with in these textbooks, the treatment of Native Americans, et cetera. My guess is that somewhat whitewashed, you're not going to get the history of blacks or African Americans in the United States and talk about racism from the beginning of the country. So I think that if it's going to have curriculum regarding with disabilities, I'm glad to see that they would cover the accomplishments that people have made and the changes. But I think they really need to make sure that people are aware of the fact that millions of people still suffer in this country with disabilities, and they get discriminated against, and it's still happening. And they really have a hard time. Many of us have a difficult time dealing with this issue, even in our local communities.
Yeah, it's a great point. Thank you for the question, Gray. Christina, do you want to take that?
I certainly, as a person with a disability myself, I certainly agree with Greg, and as an advocate, I cannot agree with you more, Greg. And I'm not sure how the curriculum will come out in the end, but I do agree that, you know, discrimination is part of our history. It's a part of our today, and I think it's something that's very relevant and should be included, but I also think that it's important and has a role for us to play. In the bill, the Fair Education Act, it did include language around the curriculum development being in collaboration with community members who are a part of those communities. So I think that, you know, the Department of Education has an opportunity to work with those of us to get a real picture of what the disability rights movement is like today and historically, so that we do get to paint the realistic picture that many of us face on an ongoing basis.
And if people want to contribute or use their voice on this issue, what's the best way to go about doing that, Christina?
I would certainly encourage them to reach out to the Department of Education, the Curriculum Council, or the Curriculum Committee that is overseeing this and putting the curriculum together. I know just recently at our Special Education Advisory Committee meeting last week, we had the Longmore Institute come out and present on the Patients No More exhibit and some of the work that the Longmore Institute is doing. And, you know, the council members, not including myself, of course, but the other council members were moved by the presentation, because even them, as special education providers, professionals, and parents, they did not know that that history existed, and they got so empowered and excited about it. They said, oh my gosh, Christina, can we get that exhibit over at the Department of Education during our next meeting? And, you know, they've got plans of booking that exhibit if we can afford to book it, and looking at other resources that exist. And for the first time, I was like, wow, people are getting it. Non-disabled people, or people who have non-apparent disabilities that don't want to disclose yet because they're not comfortable with it, because disability hasn't historically been seen as a positive thing, are willing to talk about it and see it in a different light. And, you know, we have a wonderful disability history panel, 3-foot by 6-foot panels that end up being, I want to say, 10 feet long, that we can put out on display and that we've used at different places and conferences around the state. And I said, you know, we've got a lot of different resources that can be used. It's just a matter of being able to connect with those of us with disabilities that are in the community that know what exists and what is out there and available to use. So I'm also going to encourage the curriculum committee to think about meeting at the Bancroft Library in the future to look at what's there when it comes to disability history.
And what would you say, Catherine? Greg brings up a good point. We've been talking a lot about the history of the disability rights movement, but what about the struggles that people still face today?
So, yeah, this brings up a really interesting story that came up in conjunction with our exhibit. Students today in the schools get something. They have their accommodations, and they're called the 504 accommodations. It's named for this law, and the shorthand is, oh, my 504, I've got to fill in my 504, I've got to do my paperwork. Do you have a 504? It's a term that everybody banters around, and they think, oh, this is, you know, some government thing that was imposed, and it seems like one weird, cold, bureaucratic law. So these students that have their, quote, 504s come to the exhibit, and they realize it's part of this whole other civil rights movement that fought discrimination, that fought, denying services, all of these things. So suddenly this student is empowered to feel like they have a connection to a movement that's way bigger than they are. And people that have that connection to history are going to be much more likely the next time they're either discriminated against or somebody says something, you know, that they don't agree with, they will more than likely, you know, say something about it and say, look, you know, I am part of this bigger thing, and I can tell you this, this, and this about history. And history can fight discrimination. I think you know that empowering moment, you feel that you're part of something bigger. That's what makes you say, I won't take this anymore, and I'm going to, you know, educate you and learn from this. And that's where you fight discrimination, when people understand their history and they understand that they're part of something bigger.
And I understand that one of your colleagues also gave a presentation to the California Department of Education, and they were blown away by these stories. So many of them had never heard them before.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, my associate director, Emily Badix, and I think that's who Christina was referring to at the presentation last week, is, you know, people are so... they're so excited by these stories. They're also hungry for them. They don't realize that they're hungry for them till they start hearing them. And then they realize it opens up like, oh, my goodness, there is a whole world of information and passion and excitement and engagement that I didn't know about and that I can now channel to, you know, getting back to Greg's point, I can use to fight this discrimination. Because I think anybody that comes into an environment with more stories and better images and all of that will be in a much better position to, you know, push back against discrimination and call it for what it is.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely an exciting time. And, you know, having kids with disabilities myself, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, I can't wait for them to have this experience.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We are talking about teaching kids in California more information, giving them more information about the disability rights movement and then struggles that are faced today. And do we know, is this going to go into effect? Is it a casual date? I mean, does it depend on when teachers want to incorporate it into the classroom? Is there a deadline for this? Christina?
Yeah, there was. So originally when the law was passed back in 2012, we were in a state budget crisis, and we're still getting out of that state budget crisis somewhat. So the state had put a later date on the implementation of new textbooks to come out in California. And it looks like 2017 is the year, but I'm not sure that there's a precise date within the year that textbooks are supposed to be published and then out to teachers across the state.
All right. Thank you for that. And let's go to our next guest, Gabby in San Francisco. Hi, Gabby. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment and say thank you so much for the program and for bringing up this topic. It's really relevant. There's a great inclusion program at the Presidio Child Development Center, which I thought was a good model early on to, you know, have maybe one child with autism, you know, higher functioning autism come and join the rest of the class. And using the Reggio philosophy, where art is one of the languages that kids use, it was really helpful. I see this also throughout the district in SFUSD, and I just was curious what your thoughts were in terms of employment, if there is a learning different individual. Do you think that they should, as an adult, you know, if we're talking about this as children and knowing our rights and representing our children in such a way, as an adult in the workforce, is there a place for this? And that was mainly my question. Also, sfward.org has an artist call regarding this subject. So thank you.
All right. Thanks for that. Catherine or Christina?
I'm not sure that I understood the question, so I'll let Kathy go first.
No, I'm not sure I understood it either. I mean, I think there were two parts to it. One had to do with arts inclusion in the schools, and I think another one had to do – I wasn't sure if that was leading to employment prospects afterwards.
Well, would this translate into the workforce to educate – I thought it was to educate people at work about these issues. Because if you're working with someone with a disability – you know, HR might talk to people about that, but I've never heard of anything like that.
I guess to pull it back to the topic of FAIR and education and all that and learning history, I think history curriculum is in a better position to influence future employers probably than arts curriculum, because I think history I wouldn't deny arts curriculum. I think it's great, and I think, you know, I don't want to do that. But I think in terms of the actual connections with employment possibilities, I think that that would connect more to, you know, somebody in a position to maybe hire somebody with a disability. If you think of them as being part of a history that was fighting against discrimination or a history where people didn't really appreciate what their capacity was, they would be more likely, if they'd been informed by that history, to say, wow, I'm going to take a chance on this person, or I have something more to learn about this. Arts is a generally tends to be a more, in the schools anyway, I've thought of it more as a feel-good sort of, you know, isn't this great? And it's an important form of expression. But I think that that's not where employers kind of get their excitement around this.
They're thinking towards integration of
arts. Yeah,
I would agree with you, Kathy. And, you know, I want to believe that the Americans with Disabilities Act that has employment in it as one of its titles is where an employer would go for that type of information. But I do 100% believe that disability history being included in K-12 systems is a way for integration, more integration to take place. And, you know, I think disability, and I want to also say that disability is not a bad word, because oftentimes I hear people describe it in a different way. No, disability is okay. We claim that language.
Absolutely.
I just want to point out that, you know, if more people know about disability history outside of the medical model and the charity model, they're more likely to be okay with it. And whether that be through the school system or in the community or in a future job or parents making decisions about whether or not, you know, they're going to have a child with a disability, I think this impacts so many things and changes the disability pendulum in society.
And also shows people what is possible, because I think about even today how the disability rights movement is so active, and yet you don't really hear that much about it in the media. But I remember, like, over the last 6 to 8 years, I would hear about people with disabilities flying to Washington, D.C., taking to the streets, going to the Department of Health and talking about these issues over the course of a week. And they're really, really active movements. You don't hear about them much, but that also inspires children about and students, young people, about what's possible.
Yeah, and it also it inspires the media to maybe start talking about these things more. It's always a challenge to me, because I'll go to some event and, you know that these amazing things are happening, and somehow they just don't ever register. They don't stick. It feels like there's this Teflon around disability. And I think in schools, if you think about not just people being educated, disabled kids and stuff learning more about, you know, their shared past, but if you think of a potential future journalist, able-bodied or whatever, or a disabled journalist, whatever, that this world will open up, and these stories will have more of a likelihood of sticking, and that people will say, oh, yeah, okay, this does matter, because I heard about this in some moment in one of my classes early on.
Right.
And that disability is just a part of life. It's necessarily something that needs to be fixed or cured. Yes, I agree.
All right, let's go. We have a number of callers on the line. Let's hear next from Vicki in San Francisco. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Rose, I appreciate your show so much, and I'm so glad you're having folks from the disability rights movement on your show. I wanted to make a few comments. I'm a person with a lifelong disability. I'm about to turn 65, and I grew up in California when education was completely segregated. And growing up as a child with a disability and a teenager with a disability, I think one of the suggestions I would make would be to find books and materials about leaders in the disability community of their time, what they were doing in their lives when they were kids, when they were teenagers, so that as an 8-year-old, I had read a kid's biography of Louis Braille, who became blind in the 19th century at the age of 4 and developed Braille. And, you know, hearing about a child and how that child grew up and how they then had an activist career is a wonderful way to grab kids at whatever their age level is, you know, 6, 8, 10. And for high schoolers, for the history of the movement, I would very much recommend the book No Pity by Joseph Shapiro, which is a history of the movement to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, which includes the history of the 504 demonstration as well. And I would love to see a second exhibit on the model of Patient No More, which I have seen, about taking it to the next level, which was the organizing and political and congressional push to pass the ADA. I would love to see an exhibit about that, so that you could, you know, lead from one struggle to the next struggle. And another thing that I would love to see in disability education and disability history materials is more emphasis on the fact that the disability community is an international one. Mm-hmm. And there are millions and millions and millions of people with disabilities all around the world. And what has been done in other countries? And what about leaders from other countries and the history of the development of the movement in other countries, and also international coalitions reaching out to each other, like Disabled Peoples International or like the European Network for Independent Living, that have done a lot of collaborative work trying to learn from the policies that each country has developed. And there are some wonderful organizations that are resources about that: the World Institute on Disability, Mobility International USA, are both wonderful organizations that have done a lot of international outreach. And I think Mobility International USA does a lot of youth outreach, international exchanges with youth with disabilities, going to other countries, coming into this country from other countries, including countries in the global south. So I'd love to see teachers stick their noses into libraries and look up those organizations too and see what materials they have.
That's great. I can plug a history textbook that's very good. It came out a couple years ago called A Disability History of the United States by Kim Nielsen. And it's a very accessibly written book. It's not your scholarly thing with a billion footnotes and, you know, the overwhelming stuff. It's a really good narrative that starts with the pre-American Revolution and covers Native Americans' attitudes toward disability, all sorts of things. It's a really good, useful synthesis. And you could either use, if you were a teacher or just anybody interested in this stuff, you could use it as a basis for a curriculum. It's a very, very good starting point. And I second Joseph Shapiro's book. It's unfortunate. It's, I think, 20 years old now, and it's still not as out of date as it one would hope it would be at this point. It's a really good and thoughtful book, but, you know, in a way, with all the scholarship and all the things that are coming along, one hopes that it can be updated and will be.
Well, Vicki, you shared so many amazing resources, and I hope you email the California Department of Education. Would that be a good idea, Catherine?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I think so.
Thank you so much, Vicki. Let's go next to Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I have been noticing lately how I spent most of my time on the UC Berkeley campus, and I have, you know, there's plenty of disabled walks and curb cuts and so forth, but I've been noticing lately how few visibly disabled people there are on campus, and I'm wondering if that's correct. I mean, I can remember 2 weeks ago I saw a disabled person on campus. I mean, I can remember that, so it stood out. And I'm wondering if that's in fact the case, and if there's some other invisible barriers to disabled people achieving excellent educations that I that we don't know about, and is that a real thing that they're.
All right. Thank you. Sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time. Catherine, do you want to take that?
Sure. I think there's a very vibrant disability community on the Berkeley campus. I think there's a number of groups. It might be summer, and that's maybe why you don't see as many people. I don't think there's anything behind the scenes that's going on. Obviously, there's always more one could do in terms of access and bringing more people to campus, but I don't think that there's anything going on. The other thing I will plug is that there's a very active disability studies curriculum and programs that are taking root across the country to integrate disability studies and really deepen the thinking around disability studies into areas in the humanities, social sciences, policy, everything. So, and Berkeley's one of the leaders there. They have a minor. They have really dedicated scholars and classes devoted to this. So it's happening. It's just maybe you weren't there when people were around. I don't know. Yeah, but I haven't heard anything.
All right. Thank you, Ed. We have just a couple minutes left. Christina, is there another quick inspiring story that you'd like to share that you would like to see added to the curriculum?
Oh, gosh, there are so many stories. I love disability history stories, and I love storytelling. So I think, you know, aside from the Olmsted story that I shared a little earlier about, you know, living in the community and having a choice and not being institutionalized because of government funds, I agree with the caller who said knowing the story of the ADA and how that came about, that would be very important. I can't tell you as a 30-something-year-old woman how often I go around in the community, working in the community for the last 20 years, and hear people say, I helped create that ADA. I wrote that piece of the ADA. I was at the White House when the ADA was signed. And how amazing it is to see so many people that were a part of that effort be so proud of what it has come to and what it has accomplished for many people with disabilities. So that's very, very, very exciting. And, you know, I think there's countless stories, and I could be on here all day sharing different stories.
Yeah.
And I love that you shared, you know, something about ADAPT, which is the Disability National Civil Disobedience Group, and how they do actions all over the country to give people with disabilities and educate the government on how they need to allow people on government funding to live in the community and not be institutionalized. And what you described earlier was the march to D.C. that they held. They do sit-ins and do rallies and all sorts of different actions across the country all the time for disability rights. And it's those kinds of things that, you're right, we don't see in the media enough that really do need to get more attention, because those are the things that we need to be teaching people with and without disabilities about.
Right. I'm glad you named ADAPT. The name just escaped me. But the actions that they take on a regular basis, I mean, they're shutting down the Department of Health and Human Services. You know, they are demanding meetings with politicians, and they don't back down. I mean, it's really inspiring to watch. Right.
I mean, they held up Laguna Honda, one of the world's largest institutions. They came to San Francisco and said, these people need to know they have a choice to live in the community and not be institutionalized. And still today, we have people as young as old teens and young 20-year-olds living in Laguna Honda, not knowing that they have options.
Wow. Well, we will definitely do a follow-up on this to find out what actually ends up in the classroom and how that affects students' understanding of these issues. Christina Mills is Deputy Director of the California Foundation for Independent Living Centers. Catherine Kudlick is Professor of History and Director of the Paul K. Longmore Institute on Disability at San Francisco State. And if you would like to include your opinion about curriculum, check out our website to learn more about the FAIR Act, yourcallradio.org. Christina and Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with David Diane, author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans... Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He tells the story of three victims of the subprime crisis and how they exposed foreclosure fraud and forced leading mortgage companies to stop repossessing homes. They also saw firsthand the government's refusal to bring those responsible to justice. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.